working this afternoon session because we start with a very terrific tradition that Bay Planning Coalition has had. The tradition is an honor. It's an award that we present in honor of one of our founders, Frank C. Berger, who is deceased, but he has left quite a legacy here. And to tell you about Frank's legacy and to introduce our introducer, who will then introduce our recipient of the Frank C. Berger Award, I will bring John Briscoe up to the podium. John?
Well, this makes two trips to the podium, and I know there are a lot of you who are counting. I'll try to make it brief. I'm sorry that Charlie Roberts couldn't be here today. He called last evening. Charlie was our first chair of the Bay Planning Coalition, and with Frank and myself and a few others, the founders back in late 1982. Charlie was severely wounded at the Battle of Inchon in 1950. He took a grenade hit, piece of shrapnel lodged in his spine, and the Army doctors decided against removing it, saying, "You'll be just fine, sir." I think he was a captain at the time, became Colonel Charles Roberts, one of many illustrious predecessors of the gentleman I'm about to introduce. And sure enough, they said, "But in about 50 years, you're going to have difficulty walking." And in 2000, 50 years later, Charlie began having severe difficulty walking. He wanted to be here, and I'm sorry he can't be. I know Lieutenant Colonel Farrell was eager to meet him, and I wanted to introduce the two of them. But it was, in fact, in 1982 that Frank and Charlie, and just to speak personally for a second, they were both to me, my father died when I was very young, and both Colonel Berger and Colonel Roberts were like big brothers to me and to Mike Cheney and to so many others in the Bay Area. We founded the organization. Charlie was our first chair from 1982 until 1984. And then Frank took over to about 85. And Frank took over and chaired the coalition for a long time, for about 4.5 years. And he finally said, "Young man," to me, "time you take over and become the chair." So we had a board meeting. This was a towering fellow with a sterling military record, and Lieutenant Colonel Farrell will tell you a little bit about that in a moment. Sterling military record, but one of the real giants in the Bay Area, a leader, a consensus builder that we've all aspired to try to be since his passing. And so on July 18th, 1990, 20 years ago almost exactly, we had a board meeting, and there was an official vote, and I was handed the gavel, and I had brought a case of champagne, and we passed out glasses, and I said, "I want to have a toast to Frank, to Colonel Berger." And so it was appropriate for me to say a few remarks, and I began by saying, you know, all too often, this was a big bear of a man. He had played football at West Point. I said, all too often, a man tells a great male friend of his what he thinks about him only on the occasion of his funeral. And I don't want that to happen. And so let me tell you how I feel about Frank Berger. And so I got uncharacteristically brief and serious until I noticed that this big man was beginning to weep. So I became unserious, ended the toast, we did all of that, and Frank died that night. And so we lost a tremendous leader. And in the months following, we thought, we've got to do something to honor his memory. And not just the fact that we liked him. It was the fact that he was, again, the kind of leader that we all aspired to be. And so we created the award that we're about to give this afternoon. And I got to say, next to giving the Frank Berger Award, the next best thing at these programs is introducing the person who actually will. Our first recipient was Charlie Roberts that following year. And so that would have been 19 years ago because it was almost 20 that Frank died. So without further ado, I would like to introduce our district commander of the Corps of Engineers here, who has succeeded. Frank Berger was district commander from 1966 until 1969. Charlie Roberts was from 1969 until 1972. We have at least one. I saw Len Cardoza here, one other former district commander. And in deference to military protocol, much as I would like to tell you about Lieutenant Colonel Farrell, I will not. But, sir, would you please do the honor?
It is my honor. Oh, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Farrell, the district commander for the San Francisco Engineer District. It's my honor to present Mr. Omar Benjamin the Frank Berger Award. And I say present. You know, normally you come to these things, I've been to a lot of them, and you say, we're going to give Mr. Benjamin an award. Well, we're not giving him anything. He's earned it, and we're presenting it. And I like to just highlight that from the beginning, because you have to earn this award, because it is a tradition. So, sir, we're here to present you an award that's well-earned. But what type of award is it, and really what does it present? Because, again, I go to a lot of these things. I've never presented anything. Ma'am, sir, thank you for allowing me the opportunity. Normally, I'm sitting out there, which is a lot easier. But I go to these things, and they mention the person, and I don't know about the person. And if you know about the person and what he or she did during his or her life, then you can get a better appreciation of what type of person Mr. Benjamin is. So I'd like to take a couple steps back, really peel back the onion about Mr. Frank Berger, and then you can appreciate him a little bit better and appreciate the award. It took him 7 years to get through college, not because he was not smart, but because Pearl Harbor was bombed. And I, like most people going to West Point, he matriculated in 1940. They pulled all the cadets pretty much out of West Point, and they said, you're either going to go to Europe, the Pacific, or you're going to train soldiers. So because he was actually junior in his cadetship, they say, you're going to train soldiers, and he trained them throughout the United States, Camp Shelby and a couple of other camps. So he did that for approximately 4 years, and then he graduates in 1947. It starts in 1940, pulled out after Pearl Harbor, and then he trained soldiers. And it's funny because, you know, the military has very great records, and I could not find anywhere else in the history of the United States Military Academy where this happened. He graduates number two, and number one is his brother. His brother was first in his class, and he was second, which is really incredible when you think about it. And he and his brother both got married on the same day, the day they were graduated. And as to tell you the type of person that he was, when he died, he was still married to the same person. Had a standard Army career, and I say that because the military is very prescriptive in how you get promoted. to either that's a detriment or a positive, how you want to look at it. But he was promoted twice below the zone. And I just bring that up to you because the military sits very firm, and my two Coastie superior officers here, sir, they all know that the military sets very definitive promotion opportunities. So he got promoted twice below the zone, which puts him the top one officer out of 1,000. Okay, just put that in perspective, because one out of 1,000 receives that distinction. But he's probably great, so he retires, commands the San Francisco District, and then he retires, and his greatest contribution probably comes what he does after his retirement. He finishes and builds the Bay Model. He gets the Baldwin Ship Channel authorized to Stockton. He co-founds the Bay Planning Coalition and chairs it for 4.5 years. And then finally, he more than anyone else is president of the Presidio Trust, then it was called the Golden Gate National Presidio Recreation Area, and single-handedly pretty much convinces the Army to transfer this land with $125 million to the Presidio. And that's why he's buried there. So again, think of that impact that one person had. And that's similar. You look at that, and that's why we're presenting the award to Mr. Benjamin, because this person, too, has had that type of impact. When you think of just the impact that the Port of Oakland has on the community, it's enormous. And before I get into that, I want to talk about the award. You know, when you go to the Bay Planning Coalition website, you can read about the award. And like any award anywhere, there'll be paragraphs and pages of how you qualify for the award, what you have to do to earn the award. And after you read it, you realize you know less about the award than when you started, because it's just incomprehensible. So I got with Mr. Briscoe, and I said, what is this award really present? Again, not given. What is this award presented for? And it's presented for three things, and I'm quoting him. It's presented for leadership in the community. Okay, you have to be a leader in the community, and he is. It's presented for promoting the environment and environmental stewardship. I think most people today realize that the environment is an important part of our lives. We have to protect it, and the Bay Area is a pristine a place. And again, the Port of Oakland is committed to the environment. And the third thing it's given for is supporting commerce. and commercial navigation. Because, again, we need to support commerce. It goes hand in hand with the environment. I was looking at this beautiful hotel we're in. It's about 20 stories. Someone had to put the money out for it. That involves risk. You know, buildings do go bankrupt. Someone had to fund it. Someone had to build it. So it's the ability to provide leadership and supporting the environment and supporting commerce and commercial navigation that presents the award. And I'm quoting Mr. Briscoe, and this fine gentleman here has done that. And how does he do that as the director of the Port of Oakland? The Port of Oakland is probably one of the top five ports. And I say the word probably because I hate to get involved with numbers. You know, because one year you're number three, and this next year you're number two, and the next year you're number four. And people track numbers. It's a huge operation, and it affects thousands of lives. But unlike other places, it's not just a port. And I say that because it owns an airport, and it's a huge real estate holding company. And being in the military, obviously, I've had the luxury of living in 11 different states. I don't say it's a luxury when the Army says you're moving, but again, I've never seen another port as diverse as the Port of Oakland. I mean that. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Port Authority doesn't manage JFK. Completely different entity. But if there's a problem with the port, if there's a problem with the airport, someone's going to him. He directly supervises approximately 1,000 people. 1,000 people, and that's just incredible. And that's not the multipliers, the contractors, the airline pilots, the people that work at all these operations. And then once you get into the economic multipliers, you know, you can go to the Department of Labor, Department of Commerce, 3-to-1. There's probably 10,000 people, 10,000 people going to work that depend on him. And that's about 50,000 people, you know, because 4 to 5 people per family that rely on him. And it's about jobs. And I say that because, again, it's about insurance, medical insurance, health insurance, dental insurance. And at the end of the day, it is this individual that is helping support those people. Again, Port of Oakland, huge operation. And then finally, I'd like to point out, it's not only the port, it's not only the airport, it's Jack London Square. So when I bring my parents out here and I was eating in Jack London Square, I didn't know it was owned by the Port of Oakland. I did when I did my research. So again, sir, for your, I can go on and on, but again, for your leadership in the community, for your support to the commerce, for your protection of the environment, and for how many people you influence, the Bay Planning Coalition is going to present to you the Frank Berger Award. So please welcome, give a warm round of welcome to Mr. Omar Benton.
Put that up there like that. Well, thank you. Thank you, Lieutenant. And I want to express our appreciation on behalf of the port for all the work that you have done in combination with everybody here and the Bay Planning Coalition to complete that 50-foot dredging project that's been so critical to us. Thank you. I'm truly honored by this award and humbled by it. I feel very privileged to be here to accept this honor, not just for myself, but really everybody who's here in the room, all my colleagues at the Port of Oakland, some of who are with us here, our board members, everybody who's been on the team. And I just want to mention some of those folks, some who are here, but people who have been part of really our success and the reason why I'm up here, people like Jim McGrath, you know about Lynn Cardoza, Jerry Cervantes, people in the community like Ellen Wyrick Parkinson, Willie Keys, Passport Directors, Chuck Foster, Will Travis, Richard Sinkhoff, our mayor who was instrumental in helping move the 50-foot dredging project, now helping us with the Oakland Army Base, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, new partners such as Ports America, who are doing their part not just only to bring the economy forward, but to improve the environment by installing modern state-of-the-art equipment. APL, who's going to be the first to go forward with cold ironing. Members in the labor community, like Lawrence Tebow and Barry Lubavisky. Jack Broadband, who I'll be visiting with later on, and the Air Quality Board at the district, who's helping us move forward on our air quality plan, our railroad partners, our East Bay Regional Parks, Sandy Threlfall, Brian Beveridge, Nancy Nadell. Just, these are just few of the people who are, again, part of the success and the reason that I have this honor and privilege to be here. And, of course, we couldn't have succeeded in bringing this business and managing the environmental needs as a partner without you and the Bay Planning Coalition, many of which are here today and our port board. But the port, we have a special relationship with BPC. As one of the founding organizations of the coalition some 27 years ago, through the BPC leadership, they inspire significant collaboration amongst public and private sector agencies, organizations, and the private sector. It's that model that we're transforming the port and developing the port, developing the economy, and improving the environment. I want to thank the president of the BPC, my fellow colleague, Mike Giari, and the entire board for this honor. I want to recognize Ellen as the executive director of the BPC, as you all know, has been a tireless advocate in support of balancing the economy with environmental stewardship while carrying on the important mission of the BPC. We all support commerce, recreation, and the natural environment thriving in the San Francisco Bay Delta region. We have a lot of successes that are a result of that collaboration, for example. The Colonel touched on Jack London Square. All that public access, which has beautified the waterfront residents, the waterfront for our residents and visitors in Oakland, has been as a result of this work that everybody has contributed toward. The Martin Luther King Jr. Shoreline Park, more than 700 acres protecting marshland at the San Leandro Bay. And as a result of our harbor deepening project, we reused the harbor mud to restore bay wetlands. We also used it to create Middle Harbor Shoreline Park, which is in the heart of our seaport, providing wonderful public access as well as natural habitat for endangered bay species. We're particularly proud of one of our more recent accomplishments, which was the creation of the Maritime Air Quality Improvement Plan, also known as MAPQIP. The air quality plan is guiding us in reducing the health risk from diesel pollution from seaport sources by 85% by 2020. And it was one of my proudest moments, along with the port, earlier this year when the truck ban went into effect, immediately creating a huge benefit for our community. The air quality plan was a result of a multi-stakeholder group that included our partners, members of the community, public agencies, and we thank everybody for their contributions to create this benefit for our community. The Bay Planning Coalition was a major partner in moving this environmental initiative forward, and we applaud them. Thank you very much. Where do we go from here? What is our role, and what is our part in helping manage carbon and addressing sea level change? With your help at the Port of Oakland, we want to continue going forward with the implementation of the air quality plan. Our immediate focus, as you many of you know, is to implement our shore power program that will create a huge benefit in improving the environment and the health of our community. And we will need your continued collaboration and support as we move forward with that effort, working with the Air Quality Board to maximize the amount of funds that are available so we can implement that cold ironing program to create those benefits. It's important that we go forward and continue to advocate for a national goods movement policy and funding mechanism. Why is this important? Well, we've all learned with the leadership and the work in the region, in the state, that California can do its part, but it can't do it alone. This leadership that we have demonstrated in the region and in California requires our federal government as a partner so we can go forward and implement these economic benefits, improve the environment without putting our community and our state at an economic disadvantage. We invite you to collaborate and give us feedback as we update our strategic plan at the Port of Oakland. We're now in the midst of working with everybody to update that plan for the port over the next 5 years. There are specific projects, like you all know, and are helping us to address the perimeter dike issue at the airport. And we continue to look forward to working with you on implementing the Marine Highway. So in closing, the Bay Planning Coalition has and is doing the work. And please know that the Port of Oakland will continue to be your partner with the community and industry to move the environment, to clean the environment, and move the economy going forward. I want to thank the Bay Planning Coalition for the prestigious Frank Berger Award. Again, I'm grateful and humbled and honored by this prestigious award. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving forward with our packed program, we have another profound experience coming up next. There's a couple of things that you haven't heard yet about climate change, sea level rise, carbon management. And as we roll forward into this very tight but packed afternoon program, we didn't want to leave out a very important development in the legal world. And the expert, as you all know, in the legal world, we have right here on the stage, founding member of Bay Planning, John Briscoe. Imagine no levies, the new reach of the core jurisdiction. John.
All right, this makes three. John McFaul was a congressman from Central California years ago, and he loved to tell a story about one time he made a speech on the floor of the House of Representatives, and he saw a fellow up in the gallery, sort of dozing. A few hours later, he made a second speech on a different bill. The fellow was up there again, nodding off. Finally, during a third speech, late in the afternoon, the guy was up there snoring, and the marshals or whatever hadn't quite gotten to him yet. McFaul, finishes that third speech, bounds up the stairs, comes to the guy, and he shakes him by the shoulder, and he says, "Sir, did you hear my last speech?" The fellow said, "Congressman, I certainly hope so." So I'm going to make this brief. We're at the end of the day. But there was a case was decided last October by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. And there are a lot of similarities between what this case held and the theme of our conference. They don't readily appear, but we're talking about maybe sea level rise and inundation, sea level rise of, Herr Professor Flick, a meter and a half in 50 years or whatever. You heard all about the ranges. Well, in October of 2009, there was an even more dramatic, immediate rise in sea level if you think about it in terms of property boundaries, shoreline property boundaries, and the jurisdiction of regulatory agencies such as the Army Corps of Engineers under Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act. In both cases, the shoreline property boundary has always been said, always for several hundred years, to be the mean high water line. Likewise, generally speaking, the limit of the Corps' jurisdiction in navigable waters of the United States is in those waters up to the mean high water line on the shore. Not some former mean high water line as it might have existed before, But all that was done away with, and we now have, can we have the other slide? See if I can make this. This is just an ordinary pen. That's not going to work. Now, I selected the actual words of the court because in November we had a board meeting. And we have a great, he describes himself on Sea Level Rise as between skeptic and denier. And that's my good friend Rick Rhodes. But it extends to more subjects, Mr. Rhodes' skepticism and a habit of denial, than simply sea level rise. It extends to what a Court of Appeals of the United States might decide. And after I described this case, I said, what this case means is that the property line is not the shoreline as it is, but you have to take away shore protection works, including fill, seawalls. Am I getting through? You imagine they don't exist, like the seawall along the Embarcadero of San Francisco. It was mentioned in one of the panels this morning that the financial district of San Francisco was going to be prone to flooding with sea level rise. Well, it has just been flooded with new Section 10 jurisdiction. This is what the court said. Now, I got to get back to, I was trying to explain this, and I was looking at my good friend Mr. Rhodes, who was just impassively looking at people else. Richard, you were what? And other people were, you know, what does that mean for the Port of Oakland? And other people were aghast. But Rick was just looking at me, and I said, Rick, you don't seem to be too bothered by all of this. And your reaction was something like, I can't get my arms around it. It can't be. It just can't be. That's all. That's it. But this is what the court held. The boundary of waterfront property, this is the property boundary now, not jurisdiction. This is the first bullet, is where the mean high water line would be located, but for shore defense structures. Two, the jurisdiction of the Corps under Section 10 extends to the same line. In another part of the opinion, the court says, the mean high water line as it would exist in an unobstructed natural state. Okay, what areas may have been filled or protected? And the third very key point, and the court was very pointed about this, structures waterward of that imaginary line are violations of Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act, even if they were previously legal. Now, the case was called Milner versus United States. It came out of Washington State. And the Milners have asked the United States Supreme Court to hear the case. And that is called a petition for writ of certiorari. The United States Supreme Court hears approximately 1% each year of the cases that it is asked to take. And so the Bay Planning Coalition authorized a friend of the court brief. I did not feel that the petitioner really captured the full mischief of the decision. I also felt, and it turns out I was right, that the command of the Corps was never consulted by the Justice Department about these latter two positions. All right. This was taken by the Justice Department lawyers at the trial level and again in the Ninth Circuit without consultation. So we filed a friend of the court brief, and that brief, I understand, is on the CD. That's okay. So you can read what we said. As you read it, be mindful of two things. We're trying to establish that this is one of those really important cases that you ought to take, Supreme Court. You know, it's, make it one of your 1% this term. It's not really the opportunity, it's not the occasion to argue about how wrong the decision is, but it's simply, this is really important. And I was also trying to do a second thing, was to interest the Solicitor General's office. That's the very elite office of this, in the Attorney General's office in the Justice Department in Washington, at the apex, about 16 lawyers. All they do is represent the United States in the Supreme Court. And trying to intrigue them with the idea that, you know, there wasn't any consultation below. Have you thought about the mischief to federal agencies? You know, when the commandant of Vandenberg Air Force Base has to get a Section 10 permit to patch a section of runway or to repave a runway. I mean, it's not just the impact to those of us here, the Port of Oakland, the Port of Redwood City and so forth, but it's also an enormous regulatory impact on the Corps when that descends. Now, the United States filed its brief late Monday night, and I think somebody would be waving it at me if it had been posted online, so I haven't seen it yet. Don't know what the United States may have said, whether it's trying to finesse it. But if you want to think about the mischief of the case, mischief, that's my gloss, the impact of the case, in your mind, think of a triangle of geography, Sacramento, Stockton, Antioch. Think of that. That's roughly the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. If you breach any of those levees in there, the tract, the island behind, is underwater. Consider the impact of this court decision on the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. What about where we are? May I have the other slide? It so happens that Trav, I think you were referring to when you were talking about the river earlier this morning, the core study that showed what would happen. Well, what Travis was referring to was a study done by and for the Corps of Engineers, San Francisco District, in 1959 called The Future of San Francisco Bay, 1960 to 2020. And it's a big, thick, very well researched study with lots of maps. One of them is this map. This map is from that study, and it shows the areas that were filled or reclaimed since 1850. This is the United States government's official publication. You can see the Port of Oakland. You can see Foster City, Redwood Shores. This here, University of California's new campus, UCSF, is right in here. They're going to be very much surprised when they find out that they are under Section 10 jurisdiction. My office is in here. This is the Financial District of San Francisco. It used to be called Yerba Buena Cove. The shoreline, right there on Montgomery Street. As a matter of fact, Captain Liedesdorf, the first, I like to tell Monique Moyer, was the first captain of the port. Pardon? You have to get a permit from him. You do. He said, what, 50 cal? All right, there's BCDC's headquarters. It's illegal bay fill. What a revelation, huh? This is the Marina District, yeah. We got that citizen suit provision for violations of the McIntyre-Petras Act yet? In any event, it'll be several months. I would like to think that the Supreme Court will decide whether to take the case before it recesses on June 30th for the summer. It keeps working during the summer, but it doesn't issue any orders. So if we haven't heard whether the case has been taken by June 30th, we're not going to hear until the first Monday in October. But it's also going to be equally curious for me anyway, and I think a lot of you, to find out what exactly the United States said in the brief that it filed Monday afternoon. I was hoping to have it for you, but we don't yet have it. But stay tuned. This was a far more dramatic and instantaneous sea level rise, if you will, in terms of regulatory jurisdiction than Mr. Flick talked about earlier. Thanks very much.
Gives you something to think about if you don't have enough already. So, Bay Planning Coalition is about planning, but you know we're all about action. And so where are we going next? We've got a half an hour to think about where we're going next. There's a gentleman in this room that started us thinking about sea level rise, sea level change, however one might define it, and that's Will Travis. You heard from him this morning. I'm going to give you a summary of how the Bay Planning and its allied organizations have been involved with BCDC in looking at amendments to the Bay Plan, which is a work in progress. Then we're going to turn to a summary of the two tracks this morning. I saw some of you were able to float in and out, but for those of you that stayed in one discussion track or another, we have two reporters who will come up and do a summary, quick synthesis of the core messages, the recommendations, the challenges that we're headed for and what are we going to do about them. Then I'm going to take a mic and go around the audience and ask you to answer three questions. The three questions are, what's missing from the discussion today? Is there something that you haven't heard yet that you want to hear? Is there something that hasn't been uttered? The second question is, hearing everything you heard this morning, you heard a lot of good information. What additional information is needed? What research needs are out there? Trav, I think I saw your list of about 15 items that you presented to the state on research needs on this subject of sea level change. But, of course, we also have carbon management. We're still looking at the broad topic of climate change. And then the third question that I want you to think about, if you have an answer to it, what do we do next? And there are a couple things that are already in process that we'll comment on. So I want you to think about what your answers might be and who might want to chime in. And I know there's a couple of people already who've told me they have some ideas on those questions. So, but just briefly, on the proposal to amend the Bay Plan, Bay Planning Coalition and several of you in the room have been looking over the documents and recommendations that have been the subject of public hearings over the past year on amending the Bay Plan to address climate change, particularly focused on sea level change. And what became apparent to me and to others that we needed a lot more involvement in this discussion because there were findings. There was a whole section on findings, a whole section on policies, and was recommending how BCDC was going to be addressing and asking applicants for permits within BCDC's jurisdiction, and I say within, what questions were going to be asked by BCDC of permit applicants in the future related to the environmental impacts of climate change. How are applicants going to be addressing that? So, and as we looked over the recommendations, it appeared as if there needed to be a lot more attention paid by the private sector, by landowners, by local government, and flood managers within those areas of jurisdiction. So I called up a couple of our, two or three of our major organization leaders here in the Bay Area, the Home Builders Association, Paul Campos. I think, Paul, are you still here? Maybe you had to go. The Jim Wunderman, president of the Bay Area Council, and Mitch Avalon, who is chairman of the association called the Bay Area Flood Protection Agencies Association, as well as the counties. I called up the head of the California State Association of Counties and the League of Cities. And I said, you need to pay attention to this. We recognize that there is a changing sea level, and we need to pay attention to this. This is not just a matter, I think it was Richard Sinkoff said this morning, that this is not your standard environmental issue where we're looking at the mud and saying what's in it and where do we move it, or we're looking at the salmon. Oh, how do we protect the salmon? This is a much bigger piece. So I wanted a lot of people involved with a lot of the wisdom of the experts, engineers, and the scientists. So we've had a task force that has been taking the of those associations, and we've come up with some tentative recommendations on changes that we want to make to the proposals. Sat down with Trav, had a discussion about that, going back to the drawing board. This is the process. And we'll be coming up with a final recommendation of the task force, which will go back to BCDC, and they'll put some more of their wisdom on it, and it'll be brought back to the commission at some point this year, I would anticipate. And I appreciate Travis's cooperation. He's been a terrific, and you are, Trav, a great leader in calling our attention to this urgent problem, and we want to do our best, but we want to do it right. And do the best job that we can. So just quickly, here again, the whole arena of findings. Yes, we agree. There is unanimity within the task force that there is a changing environment, a changing sea, and we've got to pay attention to it. There's short-term actions and long-term. On the short-term, we want to emphasize that there's no presumptions that anyone that has a development project in the shoreline band, whether it be restoration, development, building, that applicant should be able to go to BCDC as you do now. It's the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and present your project. How are you going to address sea level rise? Okay, that's going to have to be part of it. It's going to be a part of your environmental evaluation, as you have a list of things that have to be evaluated from the environment. But there is no presumptions that you're going to be said, well, are you going to retreat? Well, San Francisco Airport is not going to be able to retreat. But not that if there's room and where's opportunity for a natural approach, as you heard from some of the speakers this morning, we've got to consider that. So the short-term actions, we have to still focus on protection. Maintenance activities have to be supported, no obstacles to maintenance. But then on the longer term, how can we address both a hard combination of hard and soft approach to flood protection and sea level rise? Overall, on the longer term, we agree that there should be a region-wide strategy, a strategy looking at adaptation that takes into account life cycle facilities, planning over several horizons, and looking, of course, at multiple estimates and how they apply to specifically to local conditions. And that is a major recommendation of a process to be launched. I think we've already started that process here today or before, to look at a regional approach, and that needs a huge amount of public involvement, state, federal, local agencies. And here again, the authority for protection, flood protection, rests with the local government. And we want to make sure that BCDC, the policies and guidance, the advice that comes out of that, are in sync, that they be coordinated with, worked out with local government, so we don't end up with conflicts there. And I think that BCDC, that's the other unanimous agreement that we have from the task force, that BCDC has a very important role to play as leading us with our participation in a regional strategy. They have a role for coordination. They have a role for helping us with developing a consistent set of maps, and we want to work together with BCDC on that. And finally, just two final things here again. Broad public participation. There's no question that we need that, including all of you. Please see me. Bay Planning will be very involved as a top priority in this in our work program. And then the funding. How do we figure out, as we look at long-term capital improvements, what has to be done, where does funding come from? And this is a major need, and how do we develop ideas on that? So with that, that just gives you some snippets of some of the things that we've been talking about within the task force that we're working with Trav on. And as I say, feel free to call me up, and I can give you some more details as needed. So I'm going to bring up now Victoria Evans and Keith Garner, and they're going to give a brief summary of what came out about this morning, and then we'll have some fun in the audience, if I can call it fun.
Like, this is going to be fun.
Right.
Okay. So I just want to start by saying, yes, I know that gas is in my job title at URS Corporation, and I've been in the environmental and air quality field a long time, over 30 years. That's like why I look so tired. But for the first time, my job title includes the name of the species of air pollution, which is very interesting, of course, and it's hard to explain to my mother in Ohio. So, but I know that this group would understand, so there's not a misprint in the program. So in the remaining time, I'm going to try to summarize 2 hours of presentations by 9 speakers. With all due respect to the speakers, we're skipping their conclusions and their key points, and we're going to move right to the common ground. I hope there's a slide. Okay. Okay. So again, we were fortunate. We had 9 speakers in the carbon, notice no gas, it's carbon management track sessions that we had. 2 of these, we had the government agencies first and then representatives from industry. And to stay on track, I'm going to use my notes so I don't wander off target here. So in these 2 sessions, we did have a lively and wide-ranging discussion, and it did reflect a wide range of perspectives, as you might guess. We're going to start with the common ground that was discovered. And the first one I'm going to mention is so common we didn't put it on the list, and that is that it's acknowledging that greenhouse gas emissions legislation and regulations, well, they're here for the state of California, they're developing for the region, and they're coming from the feds at some rate of speed that's yet to be determined. So second, there's a general acknowledgement of the importance of strategic planning and partnerships as a common ground. Third, this planning is going to include planning and collaboration for innovation. This is innovation in technology, including clean tech, and innovation in management practices in both government and organizational units, let's say. The fourth unit, or the fourth area of common ground, is that there's a key role for land use planning and transportation planning that'll include multimodal transportation of goods and, people. So in the Bay Area, this may be a bit challenging. We're unique in the country. We do have a number of transportation modes available, and we heard about those today. Yeah. We have a unique opportunity for innovative planning to meet the multiple objectives that include carbon management in the face of tremendous growth that was described, with the potential for effects on air quality, the air quality effects on health from possibly local denser development. Let me mention mean sea level rise may also have an impact on where the development can take place. And Keith's going to help you weave this together in a minute. So that's just the common ground. Now we're going to talk about the challenges. First, there were 4 challenges noted here. First is the carbon management should consider impacts on regional jobs and the economy. So this relates to the second challenge, which might mitigate that impact, which is to develop appropriate incentives. And perhaps this might include offsets, for example, and to allow the use of other market mechanisms to motivate positive results and to motivate technological change and notice and avoid those unintended consequences. Do we feel like the guy on Ed Sullivan with the plate spinning in the air yet? So the third challenge here that was noted really uniformly across both sessions was that there is an unprecedented need for agency coordination. And as was said, harmonizing the rules and regulations to carry out greenhouse gas reduction-related initiatives. So again, these will involve land use, transportation, air quality, alternative fuels, water. You get the idea. So a fourth challenge is to determine a reasonable regulatory schedule for carbon management. And of course, there's divergent views across the government and the industry folks that presented. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Keith.
Thanks, Victoria. I'd like to take just a few minutes. I'll start by introducing myself. I'm Keith Garner. I'm an attorney at a firm, Shepherd Mullen. I'm both a planner and a lawyer. These days, I deal a lot with natural resource work, water quality, public trust issues. What I'd like to do now is just take a few minutes to kind of synthesize the lively and thought-provoking discussion we had this morning in the sea level rise track. We had many areas of common ground, with virtually every speaker, I think, agreeing that now is the time to plan, design, and construct with sea level rise in consideration. With the effect of the inertia that I think Dr. Flick discussed this morning and the time horizon that is required to develop, fund, and implement measures to address and respond to sea level rise, the importance of advanced planning cannot be understated. Another area of common agreement is the need for adaptive management. Because of the inherent uncertainties involved in predicting future sea level rise, reliance on a single, to use Trav's word, silver bullet solution is simply not possible. In fact, multiple scenarios need to be considered, along with most likely a phase funding strategies that will be needed to deal with a different range of potential outcomes. The panelists also identified some key challenges. In an era where we're already asked to do more with less, availability of funding is going to be a challenge at every stage, from planning through implementation of the process of dealing with sea level rise. This issue is even more acute since, as Mitch Avalon explained, we may not be able to build our way out of this. With no single agency or entity with regulatory authority over all of the areas that are likely to be directly affected, coordination and management strategies among the numerous federal and state regulatory bodies and the local jurisdictions is an absolute must. And of course, this coordination presents its own set of challenges. But I think these aren't insurmountable. And indeed, as we heard this morning in our track, both from Dr. Flick and from Executive Officer Shukat, this coordination is already happening at the state level, at least, with the implementation of the executive order from the governor regarding state agency cooperation. Finally, the difficulties in rallying community support, where the threat is incremental and gradual and the effects are quite broad, was recognized by virtually all of the speakers. The first steps towards dealing with sea level rise need to resonate with the public. Hopefully, this will help to minimize the number of doubters and skeptics. This summary doesn't really do justice to the full discussion we had this morning, and my apologies to the panelists. But hopefully it provides enough of a basis to continue the discussion now. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Ellen.
Great. Thank you, Keith. Great. And Victoria. Okay, the conversation is the conference, and the conference is the conversation. And I'm going to have to beg you to just stay about 15 minutes over, for those of you who can. Because we promised to get you out of here too. But as you know, we still want to do some piece of this to launch you forward into the world of decision making. And thinking about the three questions, I'd just like to tackle the what's missing. Has someone have some idea about what has not been uttered today that they would like to say? And I know of one person that wants to say something about that, and that is David Behar from the Public Utilities Commission. Is David still here? There you are. David, what's missing from today's discussion about climate change?
Thanks, Ellen. Actually, I would add even to that the answer to the second question about the research agenda. And it's not so much what was missing from the conference, but what I think is an essential part of the conversation, and that is science. Not so much that we didn't have that from Ron Flick this morning, because we did have a great overview of what the science tells us, but our ability and obligation as users of climate information to influence science, to actually help determine what kind of research is done so that we can get a greater level of understanding and certainty as to what to expect and what we're actually adapting to in the future. Not because that's going to answer all the questions for us or that we should paralyze our decision making until we have perfect science. That's obviously not in the future no matter what, but rather that the degree to which the scientific agenda and the funding of atmospheric and ocean science and ice sheet modeling and all the things that contribute to helping us understand what sea level rise is going to mean for our agencies has been developed in my opinion, an absence of feedback from the user community of that science. And it's something that the Water Utility Climate Alliance, which I'm a coordinator of, which is 10 utilities from around the country that are focused first and foremost on precipitation and temperature trends, but it relates to sea level also, are involved in, and that is IPCC 5 is already underway. It's out in 2013, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The model runs, and the science is already being designed. And my view is that we've already missed the boat for IPCC 5 study design to a significant extent. The U.S. Global Change Research Program is 13 agencies that spend about $2 billion a year on funding science and observations and modeling and all these things. And they're making an effort, albeit a halting one so far, to reach out to stakeholders and users of information and ask what they need. Neither of those processes are particularly functional from a user perspective right now, even as they develop great big science applications that are going to tell us more about climate change. We should be more influential in those processes. We should be involved in IPCC decision making, and we should be involved in helping the federal government task the $2 billion a year it spends on climate science, potentially even increasing that amount, so that we get information we need at a temporal and a spatial scale that's going to actually do us some good. So that over time we can narrow the range of uncertainty, never closing it, of course, while we're also thinking about adaptation planning. That's my view on the science side.
Okay, good. Thank you. Now I think, let's see, there's research that's been done. Philip. You had an interesting idea I was talking to you about this morning. Don't want to get two microphones going. Tell us what your recommendations are for taking the research and the science and turning it into some decision making.
Yes, and thank you very much, Ellen. I was very impressed by the discussions this morning, and I've kind of synthesized some of this into what I think is an important need. And I say there's a definite need to link climate change research to risk-based strategies that determine vulnerability and risk, that was mentioned earlier, in an overall climate change adaptation plan. The risk-based process will use state-of-the-art models that translate projected climate change impacts into risk thresholds associated with sea level rise, heavier and more precipitation, more frequent events, and conversely, more extreme and prolonged droughts. Toss in water supply issues, and we've got a real mix of information that needs to be tied together. And one of the things that we're starting to see is how these coalesce so that independent activities now are coalescing into a perfect storm for trying to manage water in especially the western U.S. And this risk-based model that I talk about develops and tests adaptations, translating them into implementable projects that are associated with construction costs, which, you know, the economic side of this was mentioned earlier is very important. And this approach targets common solutions that are obtained from the community and will accommodate climate observations and trends, future climate technologies, as David just talked about a few minutes ago, and take the uncertainty that is part of this modeling of climate change and translates it into things that are understandable to the public and the decision makers. So I've got a couple of more comments. I need to be brief, brilliant, and be gone here. But the bottom line is this. David mentioned earlier about the 2013 AR5 analysis, and the science community has listened to what the people are saying. They're focusing on decadal changes in climate that was mentioned earlier for planning purposes. They're looking at the extremes in climate. Anybody that deals with an IDF curve, intensity, duration, and frequency, the 100-year flood, if you get the 100-year rainfall event every year, something's interesting that's going on here. And they're looking at climate variability. Now, we might have missed the train a little bit on 2013, but I think that we have the scientific community's attention, so I'm somewhat hopeful here. Now, are you ready for the test? Will Travis talked about three scientists, and he left one off. So I'm going to give you some quotes from this famous scientist, and then the first one that guesses who it is, raise their hand. Number one, you can observe a lot by just watching.
Oh, all right.
What that means in English is we need to invest and continue to invest in data collection. We've got this thing called the Pacific Ocean just off the coast, and I was very pleased to see some of those images that showed where sea level is rising, the fact that the circulation may have over the last decade reduce the rise in this area. That's very important. Now, another quote from this famous person, the future ain't what it used to be. And that's tied to a comment that was made earlier about new thinking. Okay, you can only drive so far in the rearview mirror before you hit something and or drive off a cliff. So we have to have this new thinking, and the past can help us with the future, but we can't rely on it. And then finally, one more quote, and this is what climate scientists deal with all the time. They say, I wish I had an answer to that question because I'm tired of answering it. Hopefully, we'll get some answers when it comes to climate change. It's a phased process. That was an important key word that was mentioned earlier today. So that's the conclusion I have from what I've heard, and I'm pretty hopeful that with your help, we'll get to the answers that are needed. Thank you, Ellen.
Yeah. Thank you, Philip. I'd like to think about using some of the models that you've come up with in our as we proceed with our regional adaptation strategy with BCDC and all of you who will be working on that with us. In thinking about where we're going next, some of the ideas, we've already talked about the strategy on sea level change at working with BCDC, the Joint Policy Committee, on the carbon management, the policy, or at least the activities of the JPC. Is it enough for them to be looking at SB 375? Can they solve the problem of the conflict between SB 375, the Sustainable Community Strategy, and the proposals from the Bay Area Air Quality Management District to densify in the urban core? Does one cancel out the other? Does the JPC, is that doing enough for us in resolving that tension, disconnect? There's a regional summit on that next week, which I'll be at, and some of you should attend to that. We have Mitch Avalon's 50-year creek plan, which I think offers some interesting possibilities as we look long-term at doing some more natural approaches. The other thought that I had, and I'm going to then take some more comments here, is we have a San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority. Can we look at that as being helpful in making recommendations about the co-benefits of wetland restoration along with levee restoration? And can we start building some awareness within local communities about the co-benefits of that and where funding needs to come from in that arena? That's another thought that I had about that new authority. So I'll open it up. Who either comment on where we go next, what some actions are, anything that's missing, or research? Anyone have some additional comments? Yeah, Mike, Andrew.
Thank you. Then, be very short. Just a couple things. I think we heard a lot about adaptive management, or we heard about it at some point. I think what was missing in that is adaptive management cannot be just a term that's used, that's rhetoric for, in a way, decisions are made the same way. We have to be as much... we have to be willing to get it right, but we also have to be willing to get it wrong to get it right on the path. And I didn't hear a lot of that. I heard a lot of comments about we've got to get this right the first time because we don't have options. But in terms of adaptive management, it really does look at learning as we go, monitoring the information, and getting it down. So I think we heard a lot of generalities about adaptive management, but not specifics and clarity about how it's going to be operationalized. And the second thing, which we did hear about, is we got to figure out how the business community with the regional agencies, local governments, can really come up with shared principles, shared understanding of climate change, sea level rise, adaptation, and mitigation together. Otherwise, we're going to be running at cross purposes, trying to answer to different leaders and not having a good result.
Mm-hmm. Good. Great. Yeah, Jim Bigelow. All right, Jim. Redwood City, Cartwell.
There you go.
Yep.
I sit on the City-County Association of Governments. We've got 20 cities and the county, and we meet every month. We have subcommittees and the like. One thing I have not heard, and I haven't heard today, is if City A fixes up its levees and then City B does nothing, City C fixes their levees, and then the water comes in, it comes through B and hits A and C. And I don't, the happy homeowners and business owners who are near the edge of the water in our particular county, somebody needs to start shining the light so that everybody, not only new developments, but existing land uses, and in some cases agencies own land that they would have to fix, and we have a lot of money extra in the budgets these days. So I think we need to take Will's BCDC story and attach to it what can happen to you beyond the flood line, because you might find yourself in one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent, Jim. And I've this has come up before about, yeah. And actually, the need for more action. Yes. Roger.
We touched on it in the first session regarding community support. To me, I think we need to really look squarely at what I think the elephant in the room is, and that is how to really engage the public. Because if we do adaptive analysis, if we do this, if we do that, unless we can capture the imagination of people and citizens, then we're not going to be able to go as far as we can. What BCDC did with the Netherlands group to come up with designs for mitigating seawater, that's great. Only on NPR yesterday did I hear that in the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, they have an exhibit called Rising Currents. Which again, so how do we capture, I think the challenge here, we've got to do the science, but we also have to figure out how to capture the imagination of people, or else we will not get the support. My firm was involved with some of the, looking at the fire hazard problems of the Oakland Hills, and during a session, it was said that fire does not recognize jurisdiction, well, neither does floodwaters.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, other comments? Hi, who are you? Sam.
Hi, Tom.
Or Tom. Oh,
with,
and where are you from?
Sims Metal.
Sims Metal.
Hi, this is Richmond.
Yes.
And Redwood City.
Very good.
This question is more from an economic vitality ports perspective. And we in California, I think, do a good job of trying to capture as many of the true costs of our carbon impressions in this world. But
Tom, could you stand up?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. But with the Panama Canal being expanded in 2015, we are now going to be have to, California, not just the Bay in general, is now have to is going to be have to be competitive with both, I guess, Louisiana and maybe Texas. And this is more of a regulatory question with our California agencies: is what are we doing with those different municipalities and states that can guarantee us equal footing on the economic perspective of our ports? Not just Oakland or Redwood City or Richmond, but also Long Beach and Los Angeles, as those do provide a tremendous amount of vitality for both Southern California and Northern California, respectively.
Yeah, speaking on the economic side of the picture, too, one of the things that's a challenge throughout is that we have, as you heard Omar talking about, the new strategic plan at the port and the new opportunities for intermodal facilities to move cargo and people as well, and how do we marry up our long-term plans for growth and development? We know the population of the Bay Area is still going to increase, as well as carrying out this new challenge with environmental issues. So overall, that's a continuing challenge as well. Who else would like to comment on actions going forward? Something missing from the conversation? Any research needs? Yes. Michael.
Yeah, I'm sort of a member of the public. But one of the things that I think is really important is looking at the federal government and relationships to the federal government is that as sea level rises in San Francisco Bay, the New York subway is also going to get flooded. And Washington is going to have its problems. And there's this habitual reaction that if we explain it right, if we explain it right, the federal government will bail us out. And what is really, really important, I think, is for the state to take on its own responsibilities. And Trav talked about two maps, you know, that the Bay Area in the other session, that one was with the Bay Area becoming a little river, and the other one was the sea level rise map. And he said, okay, we look at these two maps, and we can see that what happened was we didn't have the future in the skinny little river. But those two maps are very different because one is, you know, is a result of natural processes over which we don't have control. And the other map was the one where human beings were filling in the bay. And we could avoid that future by stopping filling. The other one is a much more interesting one because it makes us humble. Because these are natural processes, and that sometimes our jurisdictions or our laws or everything like that are what we want. And I think as a member of the public, I'm saying, hey, wait a second. You know, Mother Nature or whatever is a lot bigger than some property owner's ability to build a seawall.
Okay. I think that's missing. Okay, thank you. Yes, hi, Joel. Joel Williams from
Bay Crossings.
Our ferries.
That's right.
Yes, ferries going to carry us to the future.
I've talked to a couple other people. Exactly. I've talked to a couple other people. The one thing that seems to be coming up a lot is public awareness, the need to get the word out, the need to get the public behind all this stuff. And I just wanted to let you know, different entities know that I do have a publication called Bay Crossings that goes to waterfront communities throughout the Bay Area, focus on the waterfront commuters and things like that. I want to invite you all to submit this material to me so I can help you get the message out there. Rather than running around giving my card or waiting for people, you can find us online at www.baycrossings.com. And I'm pretty much the only contact information in there. I'm the publisher, Joel Williams. So I want to invite you to send this stuff in for possible inclusion in future issues. As a matter of fact, I think I might be using that map on the cover of the May edition. And Will Travis has been kind enough to give me the transcript from his thing, so I'm going to print that in the next edition to show that, you know, this is the kind of stuff we'd like to help you out with, okay?
Good. Thank you, Joel. Well, gee, you've been wonderful to hang in here for 15 more minutes, and I think it's time for us to close out. And what I want to have you consider, first of all, you know the reason you're here is because you're supporting the Bay Planning Coalition and our work. And the supportive community that we have here for all the businesses organizations in the Bay. So I want you to stay with us and help us through these challenges that we've discussed today. Bay Planning will be having two more seminars this year, related topics, and you'll be getting notices of that. If you're not getting, if someone's here and we don't have your email or address or for heaven's sakes, if you're not a member, you got to join and let friends know that this is the organization to really help get things done and take care of the balanced management of the Bay and the region. So I want to do a couple of housekeeping, not so much how I'll get rid of the housekeeping, then I'll close out with my thank yous. There anyone who left materials, briefcases, any of the publications in the room next door, they are all out at the reception area. The crew had to come in and clean up for the next event. And also, of course, I want to thank the Oakland Marriott, who've done a terrific job for us year after year here in providing us with a great venue and food. I want to thank my advisors and staff of the Bay Planning Coalition who helped put this together. Kathy Thibodeau, could you stand up, Kathy? And thank you for your work being the conference director, we work terrific together. And also, I had a great, I have a new event planner, Sarah Cooper, is right here, and she helped out. Jill Rodby formerly worked in sales in the Port of San Francisco, now has her own business. She helped out with the press. And Amanda Watts, I don't think she's here. She was out helping. She works in the office now as a part-time administrative assistant. So with all their help and, of course, the help of the board, and I want to thank again our sponsors who were fabulous in keeping this. As you know, this is a fundraiser as well and keeps our doors open. So happy to have you all here. Please call me up, and you'll look on the website, not tomorrow, but shortly we'll have a summary of the conference. You have the CD, as well as we'll be organizing a summary for all the information, and come to our next meeting. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Good. Haven't done too many of the Oprahs where I'm. So you see, you can't use two microphones.
Yeah, right.
Otherwise, you get it back. Yeah, right. You didn't realize you get it back. That's right. I know. Alan, did you learn a lot? Oh yes, that's right.
Terrific.
Oh good, good.
Oh yeah, I'm very impressed
great.
With what you put together.
Oh good, good. It's great. Oh yes, you bet. And you know, I didn't see the Chevron. Well, actually, I wanted you to meet. Well, you'll meet him some, or we'll figure out about Chevron and also Mattson. I think I'm.
Yeah,
those
there,
are the two.
People are in this group that got up and talked to their own manager.
We might want
to
pull them in.
To, but I need to talk to you
about
just to get their thoughts.
Right.
If not, get them on.
Exactly.
Maybe we need to have a bigger group up there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. You can
in
think about that.
To those we've been focused on.
That's right.
So there's some work right here.
That's true. I know.